We bumped into the guy in the street and he says to him, "Oh yes, I remember your name and your face I can't get." I'm even worse than that, I'm terrible with names, but I'll try. I've let this formulate on and off for a while, and this is part of what I'm going to present for this part before dinner, is stuff I've been collating into a book form that I dip in and out of, and it's into its last part, which is interesting. But of course, in doing processes like that, anything we do, writing or thinking or reading, is part of us changing. So this is still a work in progress, like we all are. I want to present it in that way, that we can maybe explore together some of the concepts that make the work in progress. I was just thinking then, before I got up to that, interesting process for me in talking to you is that I started my training at university in physics. I was going to become a physicist. And then I switched to psychology and then later became a minister, so I sort of did body, mind, soul. But of course, as Glenn has just mentioned, you tend to jump up and down that ladder quite a lot if you're a human being. But what fascinates me across those three is how to be allowed to have the influx that starts tying them together without doing a disservice to any of the three. And it's some of what I'll be also talking about tomorrow when we do the chapter 34 in the Arcana. And my energy's a little bit low and peaceful, so I'll keep trying to bring my voice up, particularly for those that can't hear. I'll do my best. I'll probably get excited once
I hear John. Yes.
Good, thanks, mate. So I'm well stocked up with tea. I've got, like Glenn did, a few little exercises that you can do. Not so much talking, but actually experiences. I would say that they're sensual experiences, but that might get you a bit excited. They are actually experiences in the senses and in who we are and that. So I think that would be useful from Gestalt therapy in particular. Okay. I'll start with an exercise. Let's start with how you define yourself. Let's sort of have a few people throw out just a couple of dot points. If someone asks you, you know, what is a me? What's me? What do you say?
Consciousness.
So you could say consciousness, which is there, it's just a bit.
Ego.
Ego.
The husband of Mary Alden.
Jenny always gets, "Oh, you're Brian's wife." She goes, "No, he is Jenny's husband." So I appreciate that. Anyone else? What do you think of me? What's a me?
Your thoughts.
Your thoughts.
Thoughts, your feelings.
Thoughts and feelings.
Physical body.
Physical body.
Experiences.
Experiences.
What I do in the world.
What I do.
A presence.
Your presence.
Yeah.
Your spirit. Your spirit.
Lucky and honest. The power to choose.
Yeah. Yeah.
Soul.
Your soul. And Sue might got a lot to say about these other concepts that aren't the physical body, which is interesting because most of our conceptualizations of soul and spirit or the invisible things, as he says, most people actually thinking from a natural mind think of them as like will-o'-the-wisps. Mm-hmm. You know? If I was to pass the mirror around, would you see yourself?
No. Yes. An image of yourself.
Oh, great, we've got a debate. I like it. I'm back in Belfast. Well, hands up the Catholics and hands up the Protestants.
Let's get to yourself how you want to see yourself. You don't see yourself how you really are.
Well, you see a reversal of you in the mirror, yeah, don't you?
Right. You sort of hold your head the way it looks better.
That's like, right.
You know, you don't actually see yourself the way I see
you. You weren't here earlier, but I did that. I passed a mirror around one of my art classes, and I've got I basically drew around them, and they did an inside portrait of all their thoughts and experiences and loves, and then I passed the mirror around, they did an outside portrait of the face and the hair and how they look,
yes.
But that's what I was saying, they did too.
Yes.
It was great.
I loved that. So we're all on the right.
Well, he doesn't know, he was walking up the aisle in a supermarket,
yes.
And there was a mirror, and
yes.
He thought he was looking into the next aisle and thought, that old bloke, he looks familiar.
Because he was. My God, who said that looks like Hugh Jackman? Oh, no, it's me.
You can have a shot sometimes unless you look at the wrong time, or it's like if you look over, if you get old
and you look over at a glass table, oh my, what's that there? It's not like Narcissus, is it? Have you ever done that? You know, like, it's just like getting all baggy, but you can do a face and sort of go, oh look, I'm 20 again.
Yeah, well David Niven got dressed and when he had a look in the mirror and then tried to forget about it.
I had a response over here. What was there? Was a no?
Well, I said no because when you look at the document, you're looking at the container of yourself.
You can take the container of you?
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting idea.
But it's still how people recognise you. I know when my husband walks in the door because I know what he looks like.
Yeah.
Not from what he does or says or thinks.
Marriage is two-dimensional.
Yeah.
I was just going to say, like, with mother-in-law had a stroke a little while back, and the whole question of memory and who are we, that's all kind of come to the fore.
Yeah.
And so that raises interesting questions.
I love the way you put it.
Yeah.
Because Dave and I love to talk, because one of my topics I'm being developed at the moment is around memory and identity. Would you say what you said?
Well, it was just around the fact, like, we develop our memories. We tend to, our memories are like a systematic kind of history, in a sense. But with Rosemary, who has lost that to a large degree, it's more about being in the moment, so she can remember people and all of that. But it struck me that a heavenly memory, or a memory, an angelic memory, is really a memory right in the present. It's living in the present. Whereas for us, we're so reliant on these memories that we have that make up who we are or who we think we are. And when that is lost, there's a whole shift, but the person is still the person. You know, she, like Rosemary, still knows that she is who she is, but even though she can't access these memories.
I think the memories,
it's
the recall,
isn't it? Yes. Well, for her, that marriage will not be there, I suppose. Because she can't access it.
That's it, exactly. It's like you've opened your computer, but you can't get Wi-Fi. So you're stuck with what's on the computer, mate. It's those, and that's what I want to introduce a little bit this afternoon, too, is we now have metaphors about our consciousness and what Swedenborg talks about that allow us to, particularly young people, to identify with and explain and give people nice parables that are modern-day parables that actually use metaphors that are quite extraordinary about who we are. And our Lord, you know, used the parables of his time. Mm-hmm. Mustard seeds, shepherds, tax collectors. But there's metaphors we have today, which I think, and there's experiences in the physics of the physical world today, which are quite extraordinarily challenging, but actually are saying exactly, for me as a psychologist, the same thing that Swedenborg has described. I'll come to that in a little moment. One of the people I work with, who trained as a Gestalt therapist, and for the last number of years until probably last year, my ministry work was offering a free spiritual support group once a month at our Gestalt Therapy Center in Wollongong, so we have people come from around the country who were therapists, so they are trained with us at other centers. So we would sit for 3 hours, and they had the training, therefore, to do that. Like the way people might train in yoga, they trained in being present without thinking too much and allowing what emerged to emerge. And one of the guys who came was a lovely old bush cocky, who was a recovered person and really like an old wisdom from the bush about it that was, you know, cut his things really simple. I really like that about him. And he said, just off the top of his head, and I've always stuck with me, I love it. You know, the part of you, like they said, that, you know, you want to own it. And I joke with that all the time. He said, I think I'll take that and say that was mine, and I write another argument. But he said, really lovely thing about this. He said, me is memory and experience. Now I thought, wow, that's a fascinating process to play with. And that's what I'm going to play with you in a moment around that. The Gurdjieff writer, Morris Nichols, who was also a Harley Street specialist and wrote quite a number of really lovely books, I think, about Gurdjieff's idea based on Sufism and mystical aspects of Islam. In one of his books, he said somewhere which I really, really liked, similar to this. He said, when we first meet people, we see them. You know? And like people were saying before, I know that's my husband, it's him. He said, but yet, we start to realize that what's most important to people, what they love and are wise about, is invisible to us. So that most of our meeting is invisible until we unfold it. And then the Jewish mystic and philosopher Martin Buber took that another step and says that when we meet properly and fully and connect with love and wisdom, God's present. So that's now taking our identity to another space. A co-created identifier. And that's what I'm interested in too. Let's go to Swedenborg, and then I'm going to do a little exercise with you to give some sense of the expanse of what he said about the changes he went through. So what I'm interested in from a psychological spiritual perspective combined is the changes he had to go through, just the way in the lovely book The Path, which explicates the Arcana by Geoffrey Charles in a really beautiful form, I find, Gentle Innocence, talks about what our Lord went through, the changes our Lord went through. You know, I realized the other day too that because I'm a manager as well as all the other things I do, I just dawned on me the other day because you've got to manage staff and drive you crazy after one night. And I just realized the day before yesterday that not only was our Lord teach, preach, and heal, he's also a manager. He's worked with a team of 12. And my manager, who's a lovely Catholic lady, very wise old lady, I said that to her yesterday, and she said, yeah, too many reports. Bound to be trouble. At least one rotten apple. So, yeah, I did a good job managing, actually. And I'm sure he loves you. But what interests me, and this is one of the first things I want to explore and then bring it to you, part maybe what this means for you as you start to read the writings and read the word and experience yourself and go through all the experiences of being here on earth, is the journey that Swedenborg talks about. And Roberta Assagioli, who is the Italian psychiatrist who wrote about psychosynthesis, which brought a lot of lovely spirituality into his writings, and wisdom and God and love in a really nice psychiatric way. And to me, he wasn't as famous as Carl Jung, but he had a more willingness to bring God into the picture. Jung was challenged with that until he wrote his own autobiography, and then he just lets it all out, you know, that you know, he does believe in God. But Jung wanted to keep a boundary with that. Anyway, I'm not doing a lecture on these guys, but Asa Jolly says that, you know, the journey in our lives is one like that. And then, you know, we get to heights, and then eventually, if we're lucky, we get to the top. And he said some of these climbs are steep climbs, and so a number of us might pitch our base camp here or here, and we don't want to go any further, and that's fair enough. You don't have to in this life. But if you keep pursuing the journey, you'll go through changes in consciousness. And some of the main changes he talks about is you'll first of all move from this experience of self where you're a role, you know, a husband, a wife, a mother, a doctor, a salesperson, or whatever, you know, a boating enthusiast. You'll have all these different spaces you move to. And eventually he says these will all start to come together. And this is pretty much just based on what the Hindus would agree with as well in their teaching, is that he then comes to the central self. It becomes a unifying experience of self, and that when we rest there long enough, we then make contact to this higher self. And his psychology and psychotherapy is based around these movements in ourselves and what that means. So, for me, reading Swedenborg, Swedenborg definitely, Pastor Joey would, I don't think he read Swedenborg, but he'd clearly think that's the mountaintop that Swedenborg got to. So, he didn't start fully enlightened. And for many years, what the book I went to most that really, you know, particularly when I thought I was going to die and things like that, one of the books that really held me well was reading Van Dusen's Journal of Dreams, Swedenborg's Journal of Dreams, and his interpretations of it. But more recently, I go back and I read it without the interpretations. So I'm getting just the pure process, which really I find extraordinary. And what I'm getting is, in that, a developmental process of Swedenborg stepping toward something where he constantly is being prepared. And the preparation is around him realizing he's not in control. You know? And that he can have all these wonderful, beautiful, emotional states, which are addictive for a lot of people spiritually. You know, they're like, I want more of that. I'm going to meditate for 10 years to get that again. It was wonderful. You know, I'm going to take drugs to get it. It was great. I want that experience again. And he didn't do that. He was moving back and forwards from who he experienced as himself. Moving back and forwards between these high states, these low states, starting to connect that together. And starting to move between levels of consciousness. Consciousness, in terms of theory, we can say we've got, and Van Dusen writes this, you know, we've got ordinary waking consciousness at the surface. This is the state most of us are in now, unless I put you to sleep. And then you might start dropping down into a sleep state. And in between that, there's the hypnagogic type states, where you're still somewhat conscious. But it's a bit like when you're starting to go to sleep when you've experienced that, and you start to go, oh, and then you might have a myoclonic spasm and jump awake, but you've had a little vision. Anyone had those little hypnagogic experiences? Yeah. And then your partner in bed goes, so jump like that, I'll just go to sleep. and the one of the Upanishads talks about that too. They just said there's four states: waking, deep sleep, dream state, and then like this deep nirvana type state that they don't know how to explain that. Or if they did, they weren't going to tell us, which sometimes happens with the ancient mystical writings. They say, you know, it's a dark, it's a nirvana, we can't put it into words for you. But in these processes, we might move to sleep, we might then move to like a dreaming state, we might then move to I don't know if Van Dusen puts it in this order, I'm not sure if it is the right order anyway. We might put, which is a lovely one that I think he probably invented, inner instruction. I mean, everyone's had dreams. Hands up who has had dreams. Anyone not had dreams? Probably a better question. And they find out in sleep laboratories that the people that everybody does dream, only about half the people say they remember them. But if you wake them up in just before and after rapid eye movement sleep, they're dreaming. You know? In fact, having run dream groups for a while when I was younger, with Jungian type people sometimes, there'd be people come along and there'll always be someone who says, I don't know why I've come to this workshop and never dreamed, you know. But a couple of sessions into it, they go, oh, I had a dream, look, here it is, I wrote it down, I was packing boxes, it was great, I've had one, you know. You go, right? And other people, one person came and said, I had this dream, and I've been writing it all down and doing the listening to the thing, and I've got it already. But I just keep dreaming about taking out the rubbish bin. Why can't I have something big? And the Jungian said, maybe it's telling you stop focusing on dreams for a while and take out the rubbish and live your life. So people, these are other states of consciousness. And like swimboard experiences, you don't move into these states, you've got less control. Or, well, I shouldn't say apparent control. But, I mean, the good thing about this reality is we think we're in control, don't we? Anyway, when you get into dream states, you start to feel like you're not in control. Now, it's more like an observer. Now, some people have been a bit cheeky and have practiced having lucid dreaming, which then Lucid doesn't talk about, but Swedenborg does. Mm. Anyone had lucid dreaming?
My daughter can.
Yeah? Well, you start to... There's a very cheeky place to go to.
Is that when you sleep?
No, that's when you... No, and you can do practices like keep an eye... People do all these little practices to do it. But it's when you sort of start to realise you're dreaming. Yeah. It might just last for a second.
Yeah.
Or a better one, which I always really like, is when you're having a dream and it's all going along and you wake up and then you keep going, then you wake up again.
Yeah.
Then you go, why did I do that? I had two more that I came back through that. Anyone had that?
Yeah.
We have a dream, you wake up.
I'm just keeping on thinking
about it. A lot of people don't talk about these things. You don't go into the bar and say, how was your lucid dreaming last night? I didn't do that. I did the dream in the dream, you know? Did you get any instruction? Has anyone had any instruction experiences? Anyone want to say a few things what that's like?
Yeah, I just had one the other night where it was just, I was kind of in the world of spirits and I was in a building and it was all misty outside, and then I realised that if you went out and tried to go out, then the mist cleared, but if you just stayed inside, then it was still misty and I had family with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that was an instruction, Gene, because I got the message.
Giving you a message, yeah. You get that sense of being explained to something, either through the experience or someone talking to you or whatever.
I was telling Ian about a dream of my father ringing me up, and I was thinking, should I tell him he's dead? Because it was so real.
Uh-huh.
And I was between the garden and inside, and the kids were coming and going, and I had to grab the kids. Jeremy wouldn't stop. Jasper stopped quite a bit. He came to the boat. I wanted to prove it was that. So he listened and went, yeah, that's Granddad, and kept going. But I thought, how can he accept it? That it's Granddad.
Mm-hmm.
The Granddad's dead. He died 2 years ago. So he listened. Yeah, and then guess what? I had an image. I was woken by something.
Yes.
And then I thought it was Jasper or something. And I thought, why isn't he talking?
Yes.
Someone leaning over me.
Yes.
Got my hand out of the sheet and went through it, and it was gone. So it was Dad visiting and talking with me about playing board games on the weekend. And
yes. Yes.
Weird.
None of these are discrete states, so there may be sort of movements between a dream where you know you're learning something, or an experience like that where you start to have somewhat of your ordinary waking consciousness while you're in a dream state. Mm. So you know they can mix together.
Yeah.
Anyone had a trance state where you're actually having really, you know, clever, like looking people actually tell you really.
Yeah, profound things.
Profound things.
Yeah. Yes.
And so you sort of realise.
Yeah.
You had that.
Yeah. And then when you come out of that,
I can't remember.
You can't remember it, but it just the way you process it. Just doesn't sound not very exactly near as good.
That's right. Yeah. Anyone had that part of the experience?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like it's a lovely experience, and you realise you're being cold stuff. And if you're lucky, as you wake up, you actually can hold on to it, which in itself is a fascinating thing.
That's when you should write it down.
Yeah, well, that's the fascinating thing, is that we can remember these other states. Have a little look at that in a moment, too, what that means for us. There's a famous author, I forget his name, but he had a really big inner instructional state, and he jumped up during the night, wrote it down, and fell asleep. And then he woke up in the morning, and it was, hicamous, hogamous, women are monogamous, hogamous, hicamous, men are polygamous. Which actually is quite profound. When you think about it, you know. But you didn't feel that way. Hey, no, couples and family therapy and all those things. So, there's a depth even beyond the inner instruction with a trance state. Anyone experience those? Those are relatively more rare. Do you want to say what that was like for you?
Well, I used to go to trance state when I was a child. I'd be sitting daydreaming and then I'd go into a state where I wouldn't talk and meet with people. And I could hear people around me, but I can't explain. My parents knew I was in a trance state, and they used to get worried about it until an elder member of the family actually said what it was and said we were alone to come out of it. And I used to come out of it with extraordinary things that I would tell my parents.
Like the instructions?
Oh, yes, and instructions for them that I didn't even understand. And they got to see their faces. Yes. But this trance is, they stopped for a while, as I went into teenage years, and then they started again when I was adult.
Yes.
So I just know how to handle it now.
Yes. And Swedenborg's Journal of Dreams is not really a Journal of Dreams, more like a Journal of States of Consciousness, because there's a number of trance states that he experiences. In trance states, there's a psychological definition of some of the trance states too. Typically, the people usually don't go to a psychologist or a psychiatrist going, you know, not unless they're psychotic, and I've worked with that too, where it's a compulsive mental different story. They get a really nice trance state where you know, this lovely other, you know, glowing being is telling you arcana, and you wake up and you go, that's fantastic. Usually I'm going to see a psychologist. But there's a negative trance state that people will report to psychologists or psychiatrists, and it seems like not just night terrors with kids, I forget the name of the other one for adults. But I think it's a Latin word. But it's where you wake up, and this is reported and not uncommon at times. You may have experienced this. And these levels of trance states is where you actually feel you've woken up in your body, in your room, but you can't move.
Oh, I have that when I have a fever. Yeah.
And these are the ones, often if they're a negative one, people may report it to a counselor or something. And
you're
often,
not dreaming. You're
no, you're not right. Dreaming.
Okay,
yes, because in a dream state, your body immobilizes itself so that you can dream and not move around. So,
I didn't know what other was this something wrong with it.
Yeah, no, these are states, well, that people experience. And probably one of the scary states is where you might wake up and you feel a dark shape in the room. And sometimes you feel it moving over you. And you might even feel the shape go woof, and then you go, what was that? And you can move again. Yes. And there's another, yeah, thanks for reminding me, there's another one where you feel pressured on.
I've had one where I've had a fever. I was absolutely certain I'd got up, dragged myself out of the room and gone somewhere. And I was sure that I was in the other room, but I wasn't.
So this is becoming like states of conscious anonymous meetings. I want to admit that I have a state of consciousness and I had no control over it, and I'm surrendering to a higher power because these things have to do it. It just means in the 70s and even in the 80s, these things were more topical. People had got in groups about these things and like to do Jungian things, those sort of books. That's all gone nowadays. People aren't interested in that nowadays.
Yeah.
They're interested in quick, fast, how do I problem solve, how do I use meditation to be a mindfulness good worker and manage clients. And it's all very pragmatic, almost utilitarian stuff, which isn't as soft as what we had in the 70s.
I've had a similar sort of thing, like waking and not being able to move, but a very distinct image, which was quite alarming at the time, of actually a person standing there with an axe.
Oh, yeah.
And it wasn't manned.
No. But, I mean, I've had things like, not quite as dramatic as that, but that's that would have been like within the last 2 years. Maybe 2 years ago that happened. But by the initial shock, and, you know, straining to make sure your eyes are open, just through the experience of the writings, immediately the thought went to this is spiritual world stuff, you know, so the initial alarm just drops straight away, and the mind goes, I wonder what this is about, and then
And, you know, if I talk to any group about this, it isn't just because we're interested in spirituality. You know? Any group I talk to, if I bring these concepts in, people go, yes. I used to enjoy talking, I used to do a lot of presentations to New South Wales Institute of Psychiatry, and on, you know, teach crisis intervention, all sorts of things. And then when we did all the mental health teaching at the uni, and we go around all the country, and I used to love seeing people. Hands up, who's got a body? Everybody pretty much put their hand up. Hands up, who's got a mind? Yeah. Hands up, who's got a soul? Yeah, pretty much. How come we only deal with the physical body thing with injections and all that? And I just think that has to be asked, because if you work with people who are psychotic, they say it's most of the psychotic, the schizophrenia experience, happens in late adolescence. So imagine how difficult it is for kids. Because, if you're 19 and you get a pimple, it's bad for you. You start hearing voices, natural infection. But if you work with people who are psychotic, and the research shows they're actually hearing something, they're not hearing, like if I say, hear your voice in your head, or hear a bell in your imagination, and you don't get that response. But if you work with people who are being psychotic, they're actually hearing something. And the lovely story I had about that. And it's wonderful. You live in community with people every day, 5 days a week, who've got particularly psychotic disorders. And you start to have a different view of reality. But a lovely story with that was me and a couple of the staff members went to see Ghost. Remember when Ghost came out? Remember all that? Where we had, you know, Patrick Swayze and died. But he couldn't go away because he's still here and wanted to talk to Demi Moore. And through Whoopi Goldberg, and you're sort of watching that, and you're sort of going, and Whoopi Goldberg goes, if you kiss me, you'll be kissing him. And she goes, I don't think so. But you go, yeah, believe her, do it, you know. And then at the end of the movie, sort of, and then the coin moves up the door, and all those sort of things.
And
sort of, and what, yeah, and so Ditto, all that stuff. Yeah. And at the end, you finally see, and you feel, because the spiritual life shows him to her, and he's looking back. And like a near-death thing, and he says, it's beautiful here, you take all your love with you. I just think movies are wonderful now, the way they... Yeah. I'm really quite surprised, you're wondering how much Swedenborg stuff's in movies, but that's another story, sure. Or not, maybe. But, there's a bit... We went there, and four people from our Living Skills Centre, who had schizophrenia, had gone too, do you see? And I really loved it. We were standing in the foyer afterwards, talking about the movie, which is what we're doing. And they just come up to us, and they went... See? I just thought that was beautiful. But it's like that, well, you're watching a movie, you believe it. You know, you're in that level of belief. And then when you come out to this, you go, no, no, it's not true. Nice story. So that's kind of what I'm walking us towards. What happens if we actually experience other things other than this sensual reality? What that brings as we do this climb. Now, one of the trance states too that some people might have, maybe they'll wake up and they'll be, which Swedenborg experience, automatically saying the Lord's Prayer. Mm-hmm. It's not them saying it, but they're saying it, it's their voice that they hear. They're not doing it in this verbal world, they're doing it with an internal voice. Yeah, anyone experiencing that now? A lot of people do meditation, starting to get those experiences. And Swedenborg talks about if you go enough time out there by yourself in the bush or a monk or you're doing stuff, this stuff starts to come in. because it's like you're turning down the impact of the sensual reality, which then creates a space for these other states to come in. So when you present it like this, what Swedenborg went through is normal. In fact, as he says, in the beginning, we all were like that. We moved back and forward between states, and now we've lost it. Not that it's totally gone, but we've lost it. So what's interesting is his journey and what that means for us. So if we look at a shift from the journal of dream type states, where he clearly is still in a sense of meanness and his own experience of having that opened out and realizing there's more than meanness, but it's these sort of experiences that he's having until finally our Lord appears to him, you know, in a place like this while he's having his dinner and a few glasses of wine, and all of a sudden the room gets covered in yucky, ugly black snakes and things like that, and then there's our Lord sitting opposite him. And I mean, really, I really believe you'd watch that show with Sean Connery, where he's the Middle Ages detective, and you know, it was the name of the role, something like that, where these guys had hidden Plato's humor, because you know you shouldn't have humor if you're a spiritual person, and Connery finds out that there's all this lovely humorous writing. I think God's got a sense of humor. There's so much of it in the world. So if you're a mystic and all of a sudden our Lord appears while you're having dinner by yourself in an inn, what's the first thing you'd like our Lord to say to you?
Good evening would be a good start.
Good evening. Nice to meet you. How are you going?
Bless you.
Let me bless you.
Yeah.
Or, hey, you're a good man. Oh, what's what you're right? You're doing good. Keep going. It's not what he says. What does he say? Who knows what the first message you get?
Don't eat so much.
Eat, not starve. What are they doing? Oh, why? What am I doing? And you can take that at different levels, of course. But I always thought that's really lovely. Then it goes home and everything starts to be unfolded. And at those sort of points, it stops. So we've gone through this almost like first phase stage of these transformations. Then the next phase starts with the spiritual diaries. Mm-hmm. And even the first parts of those are missing. But he then moves into states of consciousness that the vast number of people, even most mystics, I don't think actually understand. And he, in his time, really hasn't got iPads and Wi-Fi and all these other things that we have now to use as metaphors to make this more explainable. Do you know? It's and when he talks about how in, you know, in the world of spirit or in heaven, you know, you think about someone and they appear. iPhone.
Yeah.
Skype. Hello. Oh, I can see you. Isn't that interesting? But for people in the 17th century, that would seem crazy. For us, when I teach what I call field theory and Gestalt therapy, some of the field theory I've written about in therapy, it totally replicates Swedenborg's experiences in the spiritual world. I'm going to come to that in a second, in our sense of identity. Most of us still know our realities through our sensual experiences, as he talks about. So when we talk about that invisible world of love and wisdom, to try and understand that, we need to step out of the physical world. And one of the things that will help us do that is some of our non-type physical experiences which broach between physical and non-physical. If I go back to the stuff I did in physics, mathematicians, for example, don't experience the world through their senses. How do they experience the world?
With numbers.
So mathematically simple. You know, and as Einstein said, you know, at first I had this notion of a field, like a gravitational field, or a magnetic field, or electromagnetic field. But it was just a theory, until, as Einstein says, now with Faraday's four equations, gravitational fields are real, from our numbers of it, which are invisible things almost. It's like a way of trying to reach through to an invisible way of knowing what visibly we can't touch, and sometimes can't measure. And then the lovely thing about when physics did that is when they tried to measure where something was, the one thing they knew is it's not there. And if we move then to quantum physics, which is what I've written about with psychology, the quantum reality, the quantum equation, says that the visible reality that we experience now is a big, wider, invisible reality. It's called the quantum potential, which when we put in the equation that describes it, if, when we put awareness in that equation, and they've got numbers for awareness, it collapses the equation and the quantum potential down to right here and now. So everything that has to be put into symbols, into numbers, in quantum physics requires awareness. This reality doesn't happen without awareness. Which, for some of them who are more spiritual writers, if you think about it, gives them a real challenge. Because when you go to the Big Bang Theory, they had to think to themselves, well, who was having the awareness when the Big Bang Theory happened? And they said, there's got one really lovely book, they said, look, we're not religious, we will just say it was bikers. And what's that? Independent governing utilizing system. So they solved it. I love it when they do that. They go, we don't care, we just know it was there, it was an awareness. We're a bit scared. So, but if we use that as an example, and it's the same thing we've done in psychotherapy, there's states of being in this physical world, because we still have all the invisible experiences that we have, that show that that reality that's invisible is happening right now. But we don't pick it up with our exterior senses. And when I'm talking to therapists about this, I say, and they get it straight away, it's like if you're a child in a family where there's domestic violence or alcohol and drug use or whatever else. When you walk home from school, you don't stop, think, look, and cognitize and think about, is mum and dad okay? You feel the field. You feel it. It's invisible. But the external helps give you information around it. Mm-hmm. And that's quite a powerful thing to do. Most of us forget that that happens. You know? And it's a connecting between visible and invisible. How we feel things. Now, there's a lovely guy, anyone heard of Milton Sheldrake? Yeah? Sheldrake's a fantastically interesting guy. He's a biologist at Oxford. And what he's been working on is how, for example, with mice, the DNA in a mouse doesn't create the mouse. The mouse is part of what he calls a morphogenic field. But just like we've got magnetic fields, electromagnetic fields, he said there's biological fields. So he's taken it one level up. It's biological fields. And those biological fields animals tap into when they're flying and they're being whales and all that sort of stuff. And it's that field that creates the DNA making the mouse, not just the DNA like an inert chemical. And he wrote about that, and people said, yes, that's wonderful, you're a professor at Oxford, that's the sort of thing you should be writing about. Then he started to think, if that exists for animals, what does it exist for us? He said, are we into those fields? So he started looking at and exploring that and writing about that. And his book, which was a number one bestseller on the New York Times list, was called The Experience of Being Stared At. And it's all about how he started to realize the way human beings start to pick up the morphogenic field is through things like the phone rings, and sometimes they know who it's going to be. Here it is. Here it is. Or someone's looking at you, and that they are. That doesn't happen all the time. We can't control those things. When you start writing these books like that, his colleagues started going, you're a nutter. And he said, no, I'm not. I'm in a scientist. I'm interested in this. That then interests me in therapy. Because working in therapy as a psychologist, those are the things, and I'll talk a bit about this tomorrow when I talk about conjugal love and working with couples and all the other stuff that's happening for couples in the world today. What we write about in Gestalt therapy, which is what Wilson Van Dusen also was one of the original writers about, Gestalt therapy, which means whole therapy, is that the sense of self is not normally what most psychologists think of as the sense of self. Most therapies see people like a table, that you can measure them and they're fixed and solid and they have an IQ and an attitude and a personality. It's a very fixed way of seeing people. Other therapies see people like they're a river. They're constantly changing. They look the same because often they have banks, and that even changes with a flood. But as a physicist know, a river is changing all the time. It's evaporating, it's moving, lots of other things are happening to it. When you apply those sort of lenses to human beings, you realize human beings are changing all the time. We're constantly in contact with our environment. We're constantly changing the physical material. And one of the most constant ways to do it is by breathing. We take in air, we put out air. And when we're with another human being, there's a self that's us, and a self that's the other human being. There's a third self, which is this, that we start doing to each other. And that particularly happens with couples. I'll say a bit more about that tomorrow. But I thought I'd give you a little experience of that, so I'm not just saying it to you. Now, I counted before, and I think we're probably one over, so I might ask David to stand up for a moment. Can you just, everybody else, just turn and face your partner. And I'm going to do a couple of simple little psychological experiments. I hope you don't go psychotic, but if not, I'm not sure about it. Turn and face the